Speaking of jumping into the fire, my next guest did it a long time ago. He first wrote his first UFO biblical book back in 1968, and ever since he's been getting it pretty much from all sides. The scientists and skeptics don't like him giving credence to UFO events. Religious folks and scholars, believers from all stripes, don't like him mixing the two up. But Presbyterian minister and author Dr. Barry Downing believes the Bible was inspired by ETs who traveled to Earth in flying saucers. You remember some of the most miraculous events recounted in the Bible? Moses parting the Red Sea, the burning bush, actually a burning and talking bush, Ezekiel's flying chariots. Dr. Downing thinks there may be an ET explanation for all of them and a lot more. As you can imagine, he catches a lot of heat about that, but he's back with a new book, Biblical UFO Revelations, 49 years after he wrote his first one. And as I told you at the top of the program, he takes no guff and takes no prisoners. This isn't turn your other the other cheek. He fires back at the critics and responds to criticism, and it's an entertaining read, and I think you'll find him an entertaining guest. We'll be right back with Dr. Barry Downing. Welcome back. The Reverend Dr. Barry Downing has some heavyweight credentials. He's got a PhD in relation between religion and science from the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. He has a bachelor's degree in physics from New York's Hartwick College, as well as a degree from Princeton Theological Seminary. He wrote a book in 1968 called The Bible and Flying Saucers, and it really stirred the pot back then, and it's still stirring the pot now. It's one of the first books I read when I jumped into the UFO topic, because it was a central question of what would happen if ET visitations were confirmed, that the news got out. How would different faiths and religions react to it? And we're going to talk about that, because Dr. Downing has a new book called Biblical UFO Revelations, and he is standing his ground. It's great to have you back here. It's been a long time.
It has been good to be back.
I don't know, Dr. Downing, if you and I have met at any of these UFO conferences, but I remember when you were sort of a regular at them, both to speak and just to hear things. And I'm really glad to talk to you. I found your new book to be as every bit as engaging as the first one.
All right, glad to hear that. The last time I heard you talk was in Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I didn't come up and speak to you, but you know, you talked about Area 51 and all that. And also, I've read your Skinwalker Ranch book, and just a few days ago, I watched the video of your talk on that. And I hope we can get to spend some time on the Skinwalker issue, because I think there are issues there that relate to my kind of work.
Well, I'm writing it down right now, and we'll return to that. I want to go back to you starting out. I mean, I've got this vision of you with a physics degree walking into this seminary, and you're interested in UFOs. People must have thought you were crazy.
Yes, well, you know, I'm not so crazy that we'll say I broadcast my views in situations where I'm going to get flunked, okay? So I didn't talk about UFOs much when I was in seminary, although I did. I was editor of my seminary paper my senior year, and I wrote to Donald Kehoe and asked him if he'd write an article on UFOs for my newspaper. He declined, unfortunately. Maybe it was good for me that he did, because I graduated anyway, you know. But I was interested in them. And the issue came up in my senior year that one of my professors said, "Nobody today believes in the ascension of Jesus, do they? And if he didn't ascend, where is his body? We may only suppose his bones lie buried somewhere in the Middle East." So in one fell swoop, he wiped out the ascension and resurrection of Jesus. And I thought, you know, when I get ordained, how am I going to do a funeral? You know, I'm going to say, "Well, there's Grandma. She's dead. We used to believe she went to heaven. But, you know, smart people don't believe that anymore. And maybe I don't want to do funerals if this is what I'm supposed to say, you know." So rather than just giving it all up, I went to the University of Edinburgh to study eschatology, time and space. Eschatology has to do with where things end up, the end of time, and tried to find out. Now, the professor had said that you know, biblical people believed in a three-decker universe with heaven up above and hell below and earth in the middle. And nobody can buy that anymore. Now we know there is no up. And I understood that. But I thought, you know, if biblical people were standing on the ground and they saw a being raised up into the air or saw a UFO in the air and fly up into the sky, it wasn't because of their worldview. It was because of what they were actually seeing. And so with those thoughts in mind, I was trying to figure things out in Edinburgh and did my PhD dissertation on the eschatological implications of the understanding of time and space in the thought of Isaac Newton. And whenever I told anybody that was my dissertation, they laughed, of course. But it got me into some good territory mentally. And about October of 1965, which is the beginning of my last year in Edinburgh, I got thinking about space travel and perhaps life on other planets, and what if they visited us, and how would you tell the difference between angels in the Bible and aliens from another world? And as I got thinking that through, I started looking in the Bible for signs of what might be space vehicles, even though they wouldn't call it a spaceship, what might have been a spaceship in those times, and obviously Ezekiel's wheels come to mind right away, but that's a little tricky. Because Ezekiel says he's having a vision, so you're not sure whether he's seeing a real thing or whether he's in a trance, you know. But I started spotting the pillar of cloud and fire of the Exodus, and I thought, now this is October of 1965, and I was in the thick of my dissertation, and I kind of made a deal with God, and this is the deal. Let me finish my dissertation, and then when I get home back from Scotland, I'll work on a book. So the deal worked. I finished my dissertation and was approved in May of 66. Came home, had no job, no church. Set up shop in my in-laws' basement on their ping pong table and brought home books from the library and went to work and started writing the Bible in Flying Saucers and had it finished by about February 1st. Of 67, and had my first job start at a church on February 6th of 67. So that's how close it was. It wasn't accepted for publication right away. It was rejected, I think, three times before Lippincott took it on. And then it went from June, when they accepted the book, until the following April before it actually came out in print. But that's kind of how it went.
You had expectations. I mean, you had expectations of how organized religion would react. But based on what I read in this book, I mean, I don't think you had any idea it would be like this. I mean, you figured the liberal Christians, those who do not take the Bible literally, would have a fit. But the conservatives might go along with it. And you knew the scientists weren't going to like it. But it sounds like from the book sprinkled throughout, the reaction has been intense and hostile over a long period of time.
Yeah, so a long period of time is 49 years. Yeah. That's where we are now since Bible and Flying Saucers. You either get hostility from the conservatives and fear that I'm a really bad heretic, or I'm a joke to liberals, okay? And let me explain the joke from the liberal point of view, okay? If you read the Wikipedia listing on Moses, what you find they're saying is that Moses never existed. He's a literary figure, like Hamlet in a Shakespeare play, okay? So obviously if Moses never existed, the God of Moses never existed, of course the Red Sea never parted, all of that is mythology. And even though that may sound radical, it's not radical in their universities. It's not radical among what you might call the elite thinkers of our age. So that's why they laugh at me from a liberal point of view. You've got to be kidding. Haven't you read any books, Downing? You know, don't you know where things are at? The thing of it is, the more you look at the UFO situation, the more you realize you're dealing with a power that probably could have started any religion they want to. And so then the question is, are the UFOs we have now the same reality that interacted with the local people, and that's what we're trying to find out.
I'm going to read a little chunk here that jumped out at me. It's back toward the back of the book, but you go, "I'm not afraid of UFOs. I'm afraid of the godless wilderness that Western culture has become with all of its technological power and no moral integrity to control it. Random acts of violence are no surprise in our godless culture. The main question is choice of weapons. I believe UFOs are God's way of saying to our godless culture, I'm back." Well, that's what I mean when I say that you take no prisoners in this, because you call out the critics and you name names and then you refute what they say.
Yeah, well, so far so good. I'm still alive, but you know, and we don't we'll say burn heretics at the stake anymore. So that, I've got that going for me. But yeah, I think the scientific culture has hurt a religion in general, but at the same time, religious culture has not kept up with scientific culture. So there's some sense in which religion is as much guilty here as the scientific side of culture itself. Listen to this from Richard Dawkins. "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak." Now, that's only part of what he says. I didn't have the ambition to type out the whole thing, you know. But in any case, you know, here's a scientist who's very bright, written a book called The God Delusion. There's no God. We've had Christopher Hutchins, I think, has written an atheistic book, too, and Sam Harris. So we've had a pile of atheistic books. They may sound radical to some people, and I realize we still have some people who take religion seriously, but religion's really been pushed into a closet in I would say, Western culture, not just America, but in Europe, too. And in some ways, Europe is more secular than we are now. But in any case,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
I would say the moral code that used to control Western cultural life is just evaporated. I mean, how many people do you know that actually could list all 10 commandments to you if you asked them, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if you were able to hear the last hour. We had Dr. Paul Kingsbury on. He's an academic who's writing about why people are drawn to these topics. Now, the mainstream culture has turned us into believers, whether it's UFOs or Sasquatch or crop circles. And I wonder if you could address the idea that regarding UFOs, are people drawn to it to replace religion as a substitute for Christianity or whatever their religion might be?
Yeah, I think I saw a New York Times article that said some guy had done a study on that, and basically it was that the more religious you are, the less likely you are to believe in UFOs, and the more you believe in UFOs, the less likely you are to be religious. That was kind of the way the study went. I wouldn't deny the results of the study. What I would say is, I don't consider myself an unreligious person, see, and yet I'm interested in UFOs. What I feel is that the gap in terms of our Western culture being able to buy into what the Bible is saying about how it came about is just too huge for most people to make that leap. So people who may be given up on trying to believe in the Bible find that they can believe in UFOs, and UFOs give you some stuff that you used to get out of biblical religion. They give you belief that there's an order up there that's watching over us, and there's some comfort in that. Maybe they're not traditional angels, but at least there's some higher power. You know, like, thank God there's somebody up there that's smarter than we are. I mean, we hope, you know? And so I think that UFOs are attractive to unreligious people, in part for that reason, because otherwise all we are is evolved from a bunch of cosmic goo just by accident. And we were not created for any purpose. And when we die, we don't have any purpose beyond death. And that's kind of what we're left in the Richard Dawkins world. So if UFOs are there, it gives us some hope. Maybe not traditional Christian hope, but at least it's better than no hope. So I think that's true, that UFOs have kind of taken their place of religion with people who don't have a religion. What my concern is that, well, my concern is just, I think it may be true that our modern UFO reality is the reality that brought about the biblical religion. And if that's the truth, then we ought to get at it.
So there's no inherent conflict between the two?
Not for me.
A lot of your book is sort of structured around the work of Bryce Zabel and Richard Dolan, AD After Disclosure. You sort of use it as a template for discussing what happens next. I remember, and just as a small diversion, when I started down this road myself, one of the first things I wanted to find out is, how would organized religion react if there was an announcement, if there was disclosure or a display that was indisputable? So I went, in doing our local reporting, went to local leaders of four different faiths, and basically they all had the same reaction, is that it's sort of a testament to the greater glory of God. It's okay, we're ready to save the souls of the ETs, whoever they may be. I didn't see any hint that people would freak out.
Yeah, I think that leaves you in the superior position. Say, we'll save the souls of those ETs. Say, and what if the ETs are here to save us? Okay,
yeah.
I think that's a little harder for religious leaders to follow.
Yeah, let's start with an example. Let's start with Moses parting the Red Sea. Your take on that one?
Okay, anybody that wants to follow this, go to Exodus chapter 14. Before 14 come verses, the last verses of chapter 13. And the Lord went before them, that's Israel, by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people. That's Exodus 13, 21 and 22. The pillar of cloud and the fire is set forth in mythical language. The statement of verse 17 is what the Interpreter's Bible tells you the pillar of cloud is. In other words, the Interpreter's Bible is a 12-volume set that a lot of ministers own, I own. It's kind of like, this is the best judgment of what the pillar of cloud and of fire is, which is, it's just something they made up, okay? Now, that's in sense. There's a real vacuum there from my point of view, which means there's no official explanation for what it is. Now, some conservatives might say, well, it's something supernatural, which you can't prove it isn't, because if anything's supernatural, then you can't prove it by natural means. So there you are. If you look at the Wikipedia listing on unidentified flying objects, it says that there are several types of unidentified flying objects. You've got saucer, toy top, disc-shaped, you've got large triangular-shaped, and you've got cigar-shaped or cylindrical-shaped. What does this mean? And the interesting thing about the Wikipedia article is you can tell that, let's just say some people who do not want UFO truth out have been very busy in editing what's put on that site. But in any case, there are so many UFOs seen that we've got types. And the cylindrical type is seen so often that it's a type all by itself. And so I think that's what we have here. The pillar is a cylindrical shape. It's solid, which is what pillars are, and yet it has kind of a cloud-like appearance during the day, and it glows in the dark.
I'll tell you what, Dr. Downing, hold on a second. We need to take a break here. When we come back, we'll pick up the part about Moses parting the Red Sea and why the wagons didn't get caught in the mud. We're talking with Dr. Barry Downing about his new book, Biblical UFO Revelations, Did Extraterrestrial Powers Cause Ancient Miracles? Included in this, we're talking about the Red Sea. Fuzzy, some of the details about this and how it's been interpreted over the ages. Dr. Downing believes, writes in his book, among other things, that Jesus may have been an extraterrestrial sent to Earth to rid the world of sin and wickedness. And boy, you can imagine the kind of reaction that's got him. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Before the break, Dr. Barry Downing was explaining that the Red Sea, Moses parting the Red Sea, the Bible's terminology is a little bit fuzzy, not real specific, that maybe the case could be made that this was technology as opposed to the power of God. Barry, please continue.
Okay, in verse 19 of chapter 14, this is what we find. The Jews have come up to the Red Sea. The chariots of the Pharaoh are coming up behind. Then the angel of God, who went before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was the cloud and the darkness, and the night passed without one coming near the other all night. So, first of all, the UFO worked as a blocking mechanism to keep the chariots away from Israel until it got dark. Then I think everybody kind of camped for the night. And then what happened? Verse 21, then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And in the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of cloud and the fire looked down upon the host of the Egyptians, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, upon their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and back came the waters, and that was the end of the Egyptians. All right. Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night. All right. First of all, they couldn't see where the Lord was, or where the pillar of cloud and fire was then, apparently, because apparently the UFO didn't give off light at night. Why, I don't know, because most of the time it did. But in any case, the next time the UFO is reported, it's hovering directly over the open sea channel. In the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of cloud and fire looked down upon the host of the Egyptians, and that means it was just above the open channel. How did the channel get open? My guess is that whatever power system modern UFOs use, if it's anti-gravitational or whatever, that's how the waters were parted. The Bible says the strong east wind did it. That was their understanding of whatever power was at work here. Notice, though, that the Lord is in the pillar of cloud and fire, so that the wind as such, they thought, was caused by the Lord in the pillar of cloud. What I think happened is whatever power system they're using, whatever force field, it would push the water out of the way and suck air down into the channel, and then the air would shoot out each open end of the channel, and so they would report an east wind blowing since they were on the west shore of the Red Sea, or whatever body of water this was. If they had been on the other shore, I believe they would have reported a west wind blowing, because I think air was coming out each open end of the channel. In any case, then the Jews went into the open channel, came out on the other side, and I think they're starting to say prayers of thanksgiving. Thank you, God. This is wonderful. This is the most fantastic miracle we've ever seen, or at least since Passover. And then they turn and look back, and here come the Egyptians into the open channel. And you might think that the next thing that would happen would be that Moses would raise his hands and the walls of water would collapse, the power is turned off, whatever it is, and the Egyptians are drowned. But that's not what happened next. To me, these next two verses are two of the most fantastic verses in this whole story, because they say that in the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of fire and of cloud looked down upon the host of the Egyptians and discomfited the host of the Egyptians, which means more or less knocked them flat, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. Now, this is weird because the word clogging in the Revised Standard Version has a Q after it, and that's your cue to look at the footnotes. and you discover that they didn't translate the Hebrew correctly. It either says that the wheels were bound or that they were removed. So either the wheels were broken off or they were bound. How could they be bound? In fact, I looked up a Jewish translation of the Torah at a local synagogue, and in their version, the wheels were locked up. What I think could have happened if the wheels were locked up is that the pillar cloud sent some type of heat mechanism down, which would heat up the both the hubs and the axles, and since they would be running in a very, small tolerance, so you wouldn't get a lot of wobbling, it wouldn't take a lot of expansion from heat on the part of both the hubs and the axles to make them freeze up or lock up so they wouldn't turn. So that's my guess. Maybe they were knocked off too or broken off, I don't know. But some kind of force was put down that caused the Egyptians to look like they're defeated or knocked flat, and for the chariots to drive heavily, probably because the wheels were locked up. That's my guess. This is just an interesting insertion because, most theories about how the Bible is put together is that, Moses was not out there with his laptop writing everything down every day. Rather, there was kind of a consensus opinion of what happened along the way, and these stories were told, and eventually they were written down. And it's just interesting to me that this kind of a detail would make it into the story, because if you talk to the average person on the street, they probably know about the Red Sea parting, and you say to them what happened to the Egyptians after they got into the Red Sea, and the response will be, the walls of water collapsed on them and drowned them. This is true, but that's not what happened first. It just boggles my mind that this little detail is there, and it's the kind of detail that I would think would make sense if you have some kind of a spaceship hovering over the open channel and using its power to split the waters and to do whatever damage they did to the chariot wheels.
Well, who knew there were footnotes? Who knew that?
Yes, well, they're here in my Revised Standard Version. So I don't know what version other people are using.
Well, let's talk about the burning bush for a moment. And I should mention, in your book, you cite some refutation by doubters who say that the burning bush was probably St. Elmo's fire. And there's a detail that's left out of that, though.
Well, yes, it's a talking bush. Yeah, it was. And the one who came up with the St. Elmo's fire thing was a Harvard astronomer by the name of Donald Benzel. And he wrote an article for a book that was put together by Carl Sagan and a guy named Page. They were both scientists. And they did a book dealing with a scientific view on UFOs, both for and against. In any case, Donald Menzel and Carl Sagan both wrote, saying in effect that UFOs are modern myths, we shouldn't take them seriously, they're really religion and not science. And it'll be interesting when all this comes out finally. And Dolan and Zabel in AD asked the question, is it possible that these people were working for the government to help keep scientists away from it, and away from asking questions about UFOs? We don't know yet, but it seems likely that when all this comes out, we'll find some scientists helped run interference with other scientists who might have been asking questions that the government didn't want asked about whether or not UFOs are real.
Well, you make the comparison a couple of times in this book about sort of the government cover-up view, comparing it to Pharaoh's control of people's minds and what they think back then.
Yeah. Pharaoh, of course, wasn't pleased with Moses' plan to free the slaves, and he was suspicious that if they went out 3 days' journey, they might not come back. And that, of course, was part of the plan, and that's the way it worked out. The burning bush was important for the fact that it was a talking bush. And notice that when we do talk about Skinwalker, that we had voices from the sky, which seems very unscientific from our point of view, but you have, if you have modern examples of voices coming that are bodiless, disembodied voices, then you're on your way to important biblical events. Not only did Moses hear a voice coming from a bush where he couldn't see a person, but the prophet Samuel also heard a disembodied voice that called him to be a prophet, heard the voice three times before he could catch on to what was going on. When we get to the New Testament, at the baptism of Jesus, there's a voice from the sky saying, "This is my beloved Son." The same thing at the Mount of Transfiguration in Matthew chapter 17, where there's a bright object, maybe a UFO, hovering over Jesus and Peter, James, and John. Likewise, the Apostle Paul was called to be converted on the Damascus Road by a voice that he heard coming from a bright object over him. And the voice of Jesus said, "I am Jesus." And so these types of things seem strange to most modern 21st century minds. But if you pay attention to some of the UFO-related materials and your Skinwalker stories, well, it's still happening. That's what I think.
Do you think it's hard to guess intention when we're talking about events in the Old Testament, but that it was for the purpose of generating a new religion, a new faith?
Oh, I think so. Basically, the biblical story says that they began with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but they had no religion per se, other than there was this God that kind of watched over us. And in fact, Jacob's wives had idols that they carried with them. So the whole point of what happens from Mount Sinai on is that idols are forbidden. And this is a shocking change for those days. And the Israelites didn't handle it well. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai, having gotten the commandments, he discovered that his brother had supervised making of a golden calf. So you can take the Hebrews out of Egypt, but you can't take Egypt out of the Hebrews, seemed to be the way it was at that time. But this is a major shift that happens at Mount Sinai, that suddenly it's proclaimed that the God of the universe is not physical in any way. It can't be put in physical form, and it's totally forbidden to make a graven image that would be a likeness of anything in heaven above or earth beneath or so on. And so that was a major step forward. Richard Dawkins appreciates this much about the Hebrew religion as it led to monotheism. He said, "It's good to get rid of all those other gods. Now we need to take the last step and get rid of the remaining one," you know. But that was a major step forward, certainly, to have a monotheistic religion come out of that context 3,000 years ago.
This idea that ancient UFO sightings inspired religious beliefs all over the planet, I mean, ancient aliens plumbs goes to that well often. You have been on that program. You write about it in this book. It wasn't entirely a productive experience.
Right. Well, I had some discussions with staff. Basically, the ancient alien people were focusing on, isn't it fantastic how these monster rock stones weighing thousands of pounds could be brought up this hill, and then they build a temple here with this. They must have had, you know, alien technology to do that. And maybe it's true. I mean, if that's true, it's fine with me. But from my point of view, when they started having me on, they pretty much ignored the religious dimension that Moses gave the Ten Commandments. And to me, this is the critical part of what's going on. This is what we have left now. And it's not clear that there was much of any technological advance given to Moses or even to the early Christians. So what was given were a set of moral values by which we might treat each other with fairness, and by which we also would see that we've been created by a source and that we have an eternal destiny. And so we have a purpose. I mean, the thing that worries me terrifically about modern culture is I don't see that anybody, that at least from our scientific point of view, what is our eternal purpose? Now, Richard Dawkins answers this by saying he's happy not having one. Maybe that's good for him. Maybe he's got a good life going. But I also suspect that a lot of these guys that are shooting people from towers in Las Vegas do not feel they have an eternal purpose. And then I think when they get on the other side, they're going to find out they did, and it's not good, you know?
You know, we'll talk about this on the other side because we've got only a minute before we go to a break, but it's kind of what you were just saying there separates you from von Daniken, the idea that these ancient ETs exposed themselves in the sky and showed themselves to early humans and inspired all kinds of technological imitations, things of that sort. But this separates you from that, in that the moral purpose. There's none of that in the von Daniken material.
Yeah,
or is
it?
I don't think so.
I don't think we so much need more morality or more technology is more morality. I mean, you know, it isn't, you know, churches haven't built nuclear weapons. And so if our future is going to be limited, it'll be whether or not we've got the morality to control the power that science gives us.
And we're talking with Reverend Barry Downing about his book, Biblical UFO Revelations. When we come back, I want to get into these ideas that UFOs, ETs are demonic, because that that version of the story is still pretty prevalent, and he addresses it in the book. We'll be right back.